This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03, Thursday afternoon, August 1st. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Credit rating is key for young people looking to rent an apartment, buy a car, or get their own phone plan. We'll learn how to build up that credit rating in our next segment. But right now, the AI and tech trade has been robust for quite some time, but the group is showing signs of cracks, and some analysts think the bubble may be about to burst. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, thank you for joining us today. We have a presidential election underway. Survivor is on TV. Tech stocks are riding high. Jim, is this the summer of 2000?
It has the potential to be, Rob. I love that intro. We have seen, obviously, a lot of enthusiasm about artificial intelligence stocks, the promise that they hold for the next 5 and 10 years in terms of reshaping our economy. All of that may come to pass. The problem is that there have been documented events in history where investors' enthusiasm ran way far ahead of reality. And the 1920s offer, I think, a pretty good insight. RCA dominated radio throughout the country. In the 1920s, you know, talk began that they would be able to provide not only voice, but images and something called television. RCA, of course, succeeded. Television networks in the following decades would, you know, show up everywhere. RCA stock went from $8 in 1921, $468 in 1929, only to fall to $15 in 1932. So obviously the depression had a little something to do with that. The point being, Rob, is the enthusiasm for RCA to me is comparable to what the enthusiasm is for artificial intelligence. And I think the lesson of RCA is something that investors should keep in mind.
We're talking to Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego, about the potential of if we're watching a tech bubble burst in real time. And this also brings up a question that I have had for you and for other guests, is that a lot of this run-up in tech has been built on the potential for artificial intelligence to be a real productivity tool and transformative in the economy, in the way that a lot of those online applications from 24 years ago eventually turned out, you know, to be that productivity tool. But if the reality doesn't meet the potential, there's going to be a reset somewhere along the line.
Well, what happens is impatience, Rob. Companies are spending a lot of money on artificial intelligence. I think NVIDIA has received about $50 billion worth of order for their chips. The problem is that so far, those efforts and expenditures have only generated about $3 billion of revenue. So what happens is companies spend a lot of money. There's a lot of hype around it, but the time to recoup and recover that investment takes longer than what investors are willing to, if you will, allow. So what happens is excitement, then it isn't happening as fast as we thought it would, and that disappointment is what causes those stocks, as we saw 24 years ago. Many of the leading stocks of the internet went through declines of 60 to 80%. I think something similar is potentially about to play out in coming years in the AI stocks.
And as we learned with the bursting of the tech bubble 24 years ago, just because the bubble bursts doesn't mean the technology is, those predictions were off base. They just eventually met their potential in a different way.
It's just that people were willing to spend way, in other words, the valuation got disconnected from the ultimate reality. And so the other thing that happened in 2001 was we went into a recession and companies cut back on spending. I think the economy is going to continue to slow. I think the risk of a recession next year is high. The same thing is likely to play out, Rob, as companies cut back after spending a ton of money on AI and not getting returns as quickly as maybe they thought they would. They will cut back. All of a sudden, NVIDIA says, yeah, revenues are up 30%. Well, that's great for most companies, but maybe if it's been growing 100%, that's where the big disappointment lies. I think that's what's going to happen and play out over the next couple of years.
Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, helping young people establish strong credit.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's important to build credit, and the sooner it's established, the better off you are. Let's get some strategic help from Matt Schultz, chief credit analyst, LendingTree in Austin, Texas, also the author of the book, Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More, How to Take Control of Your Financial Life. Matt, thank you for joining us today. And we always talk about how there are ways that you can build your credit score really while you're still at your parents' house. We talk about you can do it as a kid, you can do it as a high school student. Yep. And when you go off to college, you could also build up that credit score even as you're becoming a big man or big woman on campus.
Yeah, it really is important to get started as soon as possible, because ultimately good credit is a marathon rather than a sprint. So the sooner you can get started, the sooner you can kind of make those mistakes and learn when the stakes are pretty low. And one of the best ways to do that is by getting a secured credit card. And with those are cards that act basically like a credit card, regular credit card, which you put down a small deposit to establish the credit limit. So that makes it easier to get for folks who are just getting started.
Now, in the bad old days, we talk about students and credit cards. I mean, there was a real problem where you would have credit card companies setting up these tents on college campuses, and people would sign up for credit cards in exchange for a bumper sticker or a free T-shirt. And then they would just go hog wild with that credit card, not realize that you got to pay that back eventually. And there was eventually government action taken to prevent that from happening again. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways that you can responsibly use that credit card and really establish that credit?
Well, first of all, I remember those days very well, and I ended up getting into a lot of debt with that. But one of the best things that you can do is if you have a checking or savings account with a little bit of money in it with a bank or credit union, you can go to them and see if they would and apply for a credit card, even maybe at the branch of that financial institution. And they may be a little bit more likely to work with you than some other places would, because while you don't have credit necessarily, they have information on you and how much money you have and some other things like that. So that could be a way to kind of get started as well.
And also as an incentive, because if you are an underclassman, chances are you are in a dorm your freshman year and sophomore year. Mm-hmm. And if you really want that primo off-campus apartment, the one where there's a long waiting list, having a good credit score when you sign that leasing application certainly can be a leg up.
Yeah, having a good credit score isn't just about getting credit cards and loans. Having bad credit can keep you from getting that apartment that you want. It can affect your insurance premiums. It can affect how much you pay or your ability to get a cell phone. It's a really significant thing, and it's really important for people to get started building these good credit habits really early.
Matt Schultz, chief credit analyst, LendingTree in Austin, Texas, author of the book, Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More, How to Take Control of Your Financial Life. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, retirement strategies for self-employed and gig workers.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
People who are self-employed or working in the gig economy face special challenges in preparing for retirement. Let's tap the expertise of Ed Jurtson, certified financial planner, founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online, engagewealthgroup.com. Ed, thank you for joining us today. And when we talk about people who are either gig workers, they're freelancers, or they just decide to take the plunge themselves and open up their own business, even if that business is successful, your path to retirement is a little more interesting compared to someone who has a 9-to-5 job and a 401k plan.
Yeah, Rob, gig workers need to consider themselves, I mean, they're the CEOs of their own companies, right? So they're their own boss. And you need to act like your own boss and make sure the most important person in your company, especially for these, you know, solo companies, is you, the employee, right? So set yourself up for current and future success. And one of the great places to start is looking at retirement plans that can fit that individual need.
Now, if you do have a salaried position with a company and they have a group plan that's probably been negotiated with a big vendor through a competitive process, and you largely don't have to think about it, but if you are shopping around as an individual for a retirement plan, what are some things you need to know compared to shopping around for a retirement plan during open enrollment for a business in which you're the employee?
Great question, Rob. And the great news is for the self-employed and these gig workers, are there plans like a SEP IRA or solo 401k. These are really low-cost, hyper-efficient plans because literally they're made for small business owners or individuals in the case of a solo 401k plan. Most major custodians have these plans. Again, they're low-cost, very easy. From a compliance standpoint and from a law standpoint, they're really simple to have in place. So, you know, as we've talked about time and time again, Rob, on the show, seek out the advice of a qualified tax professional or a certified financial planner to guide you through the best option. Because while they're relatively straightforward and simple, you got to make sure it's a great fit for your company.
Now, let's say not only are you living the dream as the owner of your own small business, but you've achieved it. It's a successful small business. You were able to prove to yourself that you could do it. And how can you make the success of that small business work for you in retirement?
Oh, that's a great question, Rob. And I've learned this time and time again in my career working with small business owners. Is that set yourself up for that future, right? If it's the sale of your business or maybe you've got a clientele list, don't underestimate all of the work. And what's really important, Rob, is you're thinking about that today. You're not thinking about that, well, 6 months from now, I want to kind of hang it up. The sooner you think about the exit plan and you structure your company according to that, the more money you could potentially get when you either sell your business or transfer it somewhere else. So think about that today. But again, it's the whole complete comprehensive picture that will really help that entrepreneur, that CEO of their own company, succeed not only today, but well into the future.
Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner, founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online at theengagewealthgroup.com. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, examining the implications of the botched CrowdStrike software update.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. President Biden announces a prisoner exchange involving the U.S. and Russia. A special report coming up from CBS News. In Technology Thursday, revisiting the recent global tech outage with a look at what could happen next. Retail chain Kohl's is teaming up with Babies R Us in an effort to drive in more store traffic. WBBM Business. Markets are lower. The Dow is down 606 points, the NASDAQ is down 420, and the S&P 500 is down 84. AccuWeather says for today, clouds and limited sunshine, very warm and humid with a shower or thunderstorm, a high today of 84, 80 degrees right now in Chicago under cloudy skies at 1231.
CBS News Special Report. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, Marine veteran Paul Whelan, along with several others, have been freed in a multinational prison exchange with Russia. President Biden says their release followed months of negotiations.
The deal that made this possible was a feat of diplomacy and friendship. Friendship. Multiple countries helped get this done. They joined a difficult, complex negotiations at my request.
CBS's Olivia Gazis has more on the prisoners going back to Russia.
We have eight Russian nationals going back to Russia, among them a cyber criminal held by the United States, a money launderer, and perhaps most importantly, Vadim Krasikov, who the Russians have had their eye on. This is a former FSB agent and a convicted murderer who had been serving a life sentence in Germany, now a free man heading back to Moscow.
The Americans are in Turkey now, but headed back to the U.S. very soon. CBS News Special Report. I'm Monica Ricks.
Hey, it's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are selling off today. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist with Murphy & Silvestre in Chicago. Paul, thank you for joining us today. And yesterday, the Fed came out, Fed Chair Jay Powell came out, didn't exactly say it, and nor would he. He probably wanted to give himself some flexibility, but he hinted that we're going to have the first interest rate cut of this cycle in September, a long-awaited announcement that traders have been making bets on for almost a year, and yet the market sold off big today. What's driving this drop?
No, it's about the economy, and one of the reasons that the Fed would be cutting rates, and it's one of the things that we've talked about for a long time, is be careful what you wish for, because the Fed is not going to be cutting rates because the economy is doing well. They're going to be cutting rates because they're starting to see some weakness, and we got that weakness this morning with the manufacturing index. It came in, it was at 48, came in at 46, well below expectations. And once that number hit the tape, we've been seeing selling ever since.
Now, looking back over the last 30 years of tightening cycles and loosening cycles when it comes to credit and the Federal Reserve, normally they cut interest rates and cut them quickly in response to the economy really slowing down. I mean, the last time we saw the Fed slash rates was in 2020 and cut them to virtually zero. We saw that again in 2007, and we saw that in 2001. I think the last time, like going back through history, that the Fed began to cut and not really as the result of an apparent economic crisis was in 1995. And what are we seeing a little bit of history rhyming in this situation?
Yeah, and to a certain extent, I mean, the hope has been certainly among the bullish crowd that what's happening is the Fed is starting to tap or at least put a little bit of gas in it into the interest rate market by saying we're going to cut rates. The economy is still doing okay right now. We're just going to cut rates to allow that glide path to be nice and gentle. So that's the hope, as opposed to, my gosh, the economy is falling apart. We have to hurry up and cut rates. And that was certainly the case in 07 and in 2001. So we are maybe in a different place. And the hope among a lot of it is that the last soft landing, if you will, was in the mid-90s when Greenspan was able to engineer that.
We're talking with Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist, Murphy & Silvestre in Chicago. It is a delicate balancing act. And geez, Paul, if I got a dime for every time I said delicate balancing act on this show, I could retire. But that really is the case if you're trying to plot the course of a soft landing. You have to really determine this information that we're seeing today about the job market, about economic activity, about manufacturing. Is this a sign of an economy that's deteriorating, or is this the sign of an economy that is really kind of going back to the pre-pandemic trend after 4 years of extreme disruption?
It's a great question, and that's one of the things, you know, you're right. We are kind of in that, a delicate balance, but then remember that the Fed only has really one tool, and so you're trying to balance that delicately with a sledgehammer, and that's where, you know, if the Fed cuts rates, does that mean energy prices come down? Does it mean food prices come down? So those inner workings, if I cut rates today, when does that hit the economy? And so it's argued that the rate increasing cycle that we went through that was very dramatic is finally now starting to grab the economy. So if we start cutting rates today, we're not likely to feel that impact for anywhere between 6 months and maybe as long as a year and a half. And that is what makes the job of the Fed so very difficult, trying to be very nuanced as this data is coming in on a daily, weekly basis, and being able to look 6 months, a year, 2 years out and seeing what that impact will be, because it's not a science experiment. A lot of moving parts, a lot of things happen that you really can't control for. And that's what makes the Fed always in a very difficult spot.
And then very quickly, speaking of difficult spots, if they do cut in September, Chairman Powell finds himself walking into the middle of the tumult of the home stretch of the presidential election.
Yeah, and it's not unusual, though, that the Fed has cut rates during an election year. So, yeah, a lot is being made of that. But I don't think, again, you know, if we look at the economic data, they cut rates in September. And as I mentioned before, we're not going to feel those impacts certainly by November. So I think he's looking more at the economy, less at the elections.
Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor, Market Strategist, Murphy and Sylvest in Chicago.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday, and the recent worldwide tech outage sparked by a CrowdStrike software update set off a lot of alarms. Let's discuss what happened and what's being done to try to prevent a repeat with Jerry Irvine, CIO of Prescient Solutions and member of the U.S. Secret Service Electronic Crimes Task Force in Chicago. Jerry, thank you for joining us today. And you really don't know the degree to which the world revolves around the internet when it stops working. And all of a sudden you have a flight on Delta Airlines and you're sleeping on the floor at O'Hare because the computer system that determines the airline scheduling is completely out of commission. And it's a software update. It's someone inside the organization opening up an email and clicking on a link, and the damage that simple act can do is almost incalculable.
Absolutely. And those are not malicious attacks, but rather just either accidental or a software glitch or something that occurred. Now imagine when there is something that is calculated by a malicious actor who is going after the United States power grid or the financial institutions. All of these things today are so connected to the internet that the number of vulnerabilities that exists and are easily attacked are growing exponentially on a daily basis.
And I was going to say, but this also seems to presents an interesting divide, especially when it comes to the threat calculation. On the threat calculation side of the equation, trying to figure out the ways our systems can be brought down. You can prepare for the malicious actor. You can prepare for the army. You can set up an infrastructure to prevent somebody from hijacking an airplane, for example. But you don't have control over the person opening the email. You don't have control over the bird strike. And it's almost like the random things, the stuff that you can't plan for, that should be the stuff that keeps you up at night.
Yeah, absolutely. The number of hacks or the number of incidents that happen in the cyber world are more frequently attributed to human error, right? The larger ones and the ones that have the most amount of damage are the ones that are attributed to malicious actors. And the preparedness for these is quite different than, as you mentioned, you can prepare against somebody trying to attack an airplane or to hijack an airplane. You can have, you know, marshals on board. You can have, you know, the guards in place. But in a cyber world, people don't really prepare that way. What they prepare for is restores, right? So when a hack happens, yeah, it happened. What can we do? Your system was attacked by ransomware and it's no longer valuable. So now what do? Well, you do a restore. That didn't stop them and won't stop them from doing it again. All it does is give you resiliency to allow you to get back to a spot where you were. And there's very little being done today to protect you from this happening. There are, firewalls and intrusion detection and intrusion prevention systems, but they're all very limited in what they can do. And as a result, the vulnerabilities that exist out there that keep growing can cause even more problems. There's a website out there called Shodan, Shodan.io, that will list every single thing in the world that is accessible from the internet. So if you go out and look on Shodan and you find out that there is a known vulnerability, let's say in cameras, webcams, You can do a search on webcams for anywhere in the world or a targeted facility or location on this device, on this website, and find anything that has that vulnerability on it. And that exists not only for webcams, but for electrical power grids, for oil companies and things of that nature. It's been called the scariest search engine in the world. And it was developed so that white hat hackers could go out and try to prevent some of this stuff. But unfortunately, that and other dark websites are being used for hackers to go in and attack locations.
Jerry Irvine, CIO, Prescient Solutions, member of the U.S. Secret Service Electronic Crimes Task Force in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, a national retail chain looks to attract young families through a new partnership.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Kohl's is opening 200 Babies R Us shops in its largest stores across the country. Let's take a look at the move with Dana Telsey, CEO and Chief Research Officer of the Telsey Advisory Group in New York. Dana, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like the play here, Dana, is just get more young families inside Kohl's stores.
Exactly. And thank you very much for having me. This agreement to put in Babies R Us shops in 200 Kohl's stores was really inked in March, and now those stores are just beginning to open. The first ones that they've opened overall, you're getting an expansion of categories in the baby category. You will have online and in-store presence too. But by getting those families shopping, there's attachment sales that go along with that. So you can basically raise, hopefully, the traffic and the conversion. The sizes of the in-store shops are going to range anywhere from around 750 to 2,500 square feet. But just like what they did with Sephora and what they're expecting to do with, I think, some other new categories that they bring into the fold, it's a traffic enhancer and a sales enhancer. And especially in this category, when you have had some of the competitors going away, that should give them share gain opportunities.
Now, this seems like a pretty interesting, innovative use of the R Us intellectual property and branding and trademarks, because we already saw Toys R Us locations going inside of Macy's. Of course, the Toys R Us standalone stores have been lost to history, but that's a brand name that still has some power, as we can see at Kohl's.
Yes, it does still have some power. It has familiarity, and it's a category that has an extensive reach, and you've had players exit the category, which gives Kohl's some market share opportunities to grab, which they need.
Now, I don't know if you've done research on this, or if research in this particular space exists when it comes to baby clothes, and how many people buy it new versus how many people rely on hand-me-downs, either from an older sibling or from a friend who is kind of aging out of the infant category. How much baby clothes or baby materials are just kind of floating out there, people passing it to each other, and is that a real source of competition for the stores that sell it new?
Keep in mind, when you think of the baby gear business overall, it's a $7.5 billion industry on an annual basis, and it definitely includes a wide range of items. And what we're seeing is that the median age of a woman having a baby these days is 30 years old, so they're in a different life stage given the fact that they have more income than you were if you were younger. I have to get the number of used versus new, but definitely I think some of the new elements of it are the fact that the older consumers, I think they like the brands. I think they like going to some of these family stores and being able to buy things all under one roof.
Now they want to buy new. They don't want to roll the dice on maybe that hand-me-down onesie that may have been spit up on one too many times.
Could be, exactly.
Dana Telsey, CEO and Chief Research Officer of the Telsey Advisory Group in New York. Thank you for joining us today.